And one of the most important things we can do in this decisive decade is to keep 1.5 degrees in reach, is reduce our methane emissions as quickly as possible. As has already been stated, it's one of the most potent greenhouse gases there is. It amounts to about half the warming we're experiencing today, just the methane exposure. So together, we're committing to collectively reduce our methane by 30% by 2030, and I think we could probably go beyond that.
President Biden in Glasgow earlier today announcing that more than 90 countries will try to cut methane emissions by nearly a third by the end of the decade. Biden said that here at home, the EPA would implement new methane emissions regulations on the oil and gas industry. Is it enough? We're going to talk about this now with Pasha Madavi. He's a political scientist at UC Santa Barbara who studies energy and environmental politics. Welcome back.
All right. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, when we had you on recently, last Thursday, you said that President Biden's climate agenda in his Build Back Better plan was lacking for not addressing methane emissions. So what do you make of his proposal today?
Well, I think it's another great step forward. It's long awaited because, as you noted in the clip, it's one of the fastest ways to cut emissions. And it has been a very big problem in terms of contribution to global warming. And in fact, it was more than 90 countries that had signed the pledge. Now it's 105 countries that have signed the pledge. And in many ways, this is something that's not just today. You know, the administration, in fact, launched the pledge back in September, but has been, you know, working hard behind the scenes to get signatories. And they've got many big polluters, you know, like Brazil for the first time signing on to a methane pledge, Nigeria, the European Union, Indonesia, and even Iraq. But absent so far are Russia and China, two major emitters, as well as India. But look, this is low-hanging fruit in the emissions battle, and we need to tackle and take that low-hanging fruit because it's a very clear way to reduce future warming just looking at methane by 0.2 degrees Celsius by 2040. So that is a big, big chunk, and this pledge is going to get us a third of the way there, assuming nobody else signs on, which is quite big. And that's why Biden's called it a game-changing commitment at the global level. And it is indeed that.
Yeah. Well, where does methane come from? Mainly from the oil and gas industry, from leaky oil wells and natural gas flares?
Yeah, so it's a combination of things. And in fact, the latest estimates done by a nonprofit called the Global Carbon Project show that about 35% of global human-induced methane emissions come from oil and gas production and use, so that's about a third. 57% come from agriculture, mostly livestock, and landfills, waste. And then the other 8% is from biomass and biofuel burning. I raised that because that includes wildfires. The wildfires emit methane. And then I'm going to add on a bit more complexity. We have what's called a carbon cycle feedback problem. What that means is that as the planet warms because of climate change, it's melting more permafrost. That's a big problem because permafrost stores a lot of methane. So that's releasing even more methane into the atmosphere as a direct result of global warming. So it's quite a mix, but yes, a third is coming from oil and gas production, and almost all that is waste. Waste that can be captured and used.
So that's what President Biden wants to do, is use EPA rules to cap those, right? To maybe fine oil producers who aren't capping it and offer incentives to do so, right?
That's right. And in fact, you know, what's great about this pledge, not only the global pledge, but also the methane emissions reduction action plan that the Biden administration has released, is that there are a lot of details, which is great. So it shows that a lot of what is being planned involves regulatory changes that don't need congressional approval. So that's key. So that's things exactly like you said, better monitoring and enforcement by agencies like EPA, the Bureau of Land Management, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, to reduce methane emissions from industrial activities. So not just oil and gas, but other industrial activities that are on public lands and federal offshore waters. And that by itself is a huge slice of the pie when you think about the oil and gas sector's emissions related to methane.
When you talk about methane as a potent greenhouse gas, how big is it compared to CO2?
Yeah, so this is a hard question to answer, in fact, and the estimates vary a lot because methane dissipates into the atmosphere faster than carbon dioxide. So it depends on the time period that you look at. So if you think about a 20-year period, so methane emitted now, and you track the next 20 years, methane is just over 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And within a 100-year period, it comes down because it dissipates faster, so it's 30 times more potent, and then beyond that, it dissipates even faster. So carbon dioxide is a longer-term problem. It stays in the atmosphere for much longer. But in the short term, methane is just brutal. If you think about even a tinier window, almost 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide.
And when you say more potent, what do you mean exactly?
So the idea is, how much more heat can it trap compared to carbon dioxide? So it's looking at the impact it has on surface temperatures. And so you have the same unit of methane is equivalent to 80 units of carbon dioxide in terms of trapping the same amount of heat.
You mentioned that 57% of the methane emitted worldwide comes from livestock and landfill. So livestock are cows and their flatulence, right? Is that what we're talking about?
That is what we're talking about. We're also talking about, some of that number includes clearing forests to allow for grazing lands. Some of it is seepage from farmland, basically. So it's not just the livestock. That is the thing that people are most tracking, I guess, and it's a picture in our minds, right, of cows in particular. But it is a bit more than that. And then landfills, right, and the waste management problem, because you have some of the same processes at landfills that you have at oil and gas facilities, which is oftentimes people will either just directly release that natural gas into the atmosphere, or they'll burn it off in something called flaring. And that, contributes more to CO2, but it still emits methane as well.
And then we have the idea of food rotting in landfills. Is that a big problem as well?
That is a big problem. That's right. And so that's where, the landfill problem, which we have lots of solutions for to reduce kind of rotting, as you say, but thinking about smarter landfills, right, and thinking about easier ways to compost as opposed to just having direct emissions from methane. But, again, a big problem from waste is not just that, but it is also the release of gases as waste is processed.
Pasha Madavi, political scientist at UC Santa Barbara, where he studies energy and environmental politics. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Well, there are ways all of us can help curb methane emissions. Here to talk about what we can do is Faris Kowar. He is sustainability manager at Santa Monica College, which is where we broadcast from. Hi, Faris.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So as we just heard, a lot of our methane is coming from landfills. The EPA says it's about 114 or so million metric tons of carbon dioxide. Why does food waste in landfill produce more methane than food waste turned into compost?
Because when you're putting stuff into a landfill, it's different than the composting process. When things go into a landfill, they get smothered every day. The trucks roll in, they dump their load, they spread it out, they mash it down with huge, heavy equipment. And then at the end of the day, they pour a layer of soil over that, and then they mash it down even more, and they're squeezing out all of the air. And for things to compost, you actually need it to break down using air, water, microorganisms, and heat. But when you put it into a landfill, it's devoid of air, it's devoid of sunlight and the microorganisms that will help break it down. So it goes anaerobic, turns into methane gas. And that's why it gets so stinky. Like landfills are just a stinky place to be. But if you go to a composting facility, it actually is a very different smell. Because it's a whole different process. It does create a little bit of carbon release in the composting process, but that's a lot less potent, as we just heard, than the methane release.
Right. Okay. So that is something that we can control, at least a little bit of it, in terms of our own waste, right? As consumers, mm-hmm. like we can just put less food into the landfill, less into the garbage cans.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there's been a big focus on how much Americans purchase. They you know, have it in the fridge for a couple of weeks. They look at the date of freshness and they think, oh, I got to get rid of that. But, you know, it really doesn't need to be tossed out. We can shop better. We can, you know, use the sniff test more than just the freshness date, because that's really what the manufacturers want you to, you know, toss it out faster mm-hmm. than it really needs to be. So what we're throwing things out. We could shop better, shop smarter. But, you know, composting is becoming mainstream now. In Los Angeles, we have something called Recicla, which is the new contract across LA County, where haulers have to provide recycling along with landfill bins, and now compost bins or green waste. And at first, they really were focused on businesses that generated a lot of organic waste, but now it's required for all apartment buildings, and it's not enforced yet, but it is required. And anyone who's living in an apartment in LA can request their hauler does, you know, provide them with a compost bin. So
that's the green bin that we use for like lawn clippings and leaves and things like that.
Exactly. And now it can also accept food scraps, bones, meat, dairy, all the kinds of things, anything that comes out at your kitchen. And it's actually nicer, because if you do backyard composting, you are more limited, where you wouldn't want to put bones and meat and dairy. You can actually do everything coming out of the kitchen.
You just can put it all in there. Is there any worry that that would attract pests?
Well, you're putting all that stuff into your trash anyway. So, you know, yeah. If we have
Usually bagged up, I guess, is the
yes, thing. That is true. But these compost bins have a lid, and it's really generally not a problem. Yeah.
Are people doing this in LA?
They are. They are. Santa Monica, where the college is and where I live, was an early adopter. They've been offering green waste service for, you know, residents and apartments for a while now, and it's been working pretty well. I think that it's making a big difference, because as your previous caller mentioned, you know, it is a big source of methane emissions, and if we can, you know, divert as much out of the landfill, that's doing a lot. In California, actually, Our landfill makeup is a little different than the numbers your Mr. Madavi was talking about. But here in California, cattle actually make up 58% of our emissions, and waste to landfill, it makes up about 20%, which is also the same as the national or global average. But the gas, oil, that industry only makes up about 13%, because we are not, you know, we've done a pretty good job. And actually in 2017, I believe it was, the state passed a methane emissions rule, which has helped curb the industry's release. But there's still a lot more that we can be doing.
Right. Okay. So you mentioned cattle. That's the biggest emitter here in California, 58%. What can we individually do to reduce that? Is that just a simple matter of eating less meat?
You know, it is. That is one of the big things that we can do, is just, you know, a few days a week, replace some of those meat dishes with something else. Even some of the fish or chicken is better than meat, and actually sheep. But there are other things that we can be doing. And one of them is really pretty innovative. It is adding a particular type of red seaweed to the feed that we give cattle, because they're a ruminant. They have multiple chambers in their stomach, and it's not designed to be fed soy and corn, which cows in a, you know, typical feedlot are given. And so when they digest that kind of material, it creates extra methane. And if you add seaweed to that type of feed, it will help reduce it by 70 to 80% is what studies are showing.
So really?
That's really a neat way. And we've got all this coastal real estate that we could be growing this type of seaweed. And so that's a really big opportunity for kind of a technical fix. But really, you know, we all know that eating red meat is not healthy for us, you know, or eating too much of it. So just reducing how much we are taking in, you know, some of those meat substitutes are actually pretty dang good if you haven't tried them. So that's something I would suggest as well, just, you know, for your own health reasons to reduce your meat intake. And then hopefully, you know, these, the cattle ranchers will start to use this seaweed additive.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you for some positive suggestions.
You got it.
Ferris Kuar, he's a sustainability manager at Santa Monica College. The delights of flying during the holidays. It's looking pretty bad out there. We'll tell you about it next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Planning to travel for Thanksgiving or Christmas? Well, prepare for what will likely be an unpleasant experience. The number of people traveling is nearly back to pre-pandemic levels, but there are fewer flights, fewer pilots, and fewer flight attendants, meaning higher prices, crowded planes, and angrier passengers, some of whom don't want to wear masks on the plane. For a preview, just look at what happened to American Airlines over the weekend. It had to cancel around 2,000 flights. The company blamed a Texas windstorm and staffing shortages. Joining us now is Brian Summers. He's the editor-at-large for the travel industry publication Skift. Hello.
Hello, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you back. Well, let's start with American Airlines. What happened there?
Well, you mentioned there that American Airlines was blaming the weather. When you're a global airline and you fly thousands of flights every day, and you're blaming the weather in one city, Dallas-Fort Worth, for an absolute meltdown, you're doing something wrong. You should be able to handle a windstorm like that. American pretty much got flat-footed. They saw a lot of people who wanted to travel in the month of October, and they said, let's add some flights. Let's take care of these people and let's make some money. The problem was operationally, they just couldn't do it. They didn't have the pilots to do it or the flight attendants to do it. And when they had a little bit of bad weather in one city, it all went downhill real fast.
And why doesn't it have enough pilots or flight attendants? Is this from the pandemic days when they had to cancel so many flights and lay people off?
You know, airlines generally didn't lay people off, and that was because they took tens of billions of dollars of government aid that told them that they could not lay anyone off. But a lot of people left airlines during the pandemic. Some of the airlines offered pretty generous early retirement programs, and people said, you know what, I don't want to work here anymore. So part of it is a staffing shortage. Part of it is, look, these airlines were down to about 10% of their regular size during the worst of the pandemic. To get back up to 100%, you don't just flip a switch and say, things are back to normal, everything's going to be back to the way it was in 2019. It takes a long time to get back to a semblance of normal, and airlines and their passengers are learning that the hard way right now.
But it has been months and months and months where the airlines have had time to plan for a holiday season that they could anticipate would be just chock full of pent up demand, including more travel from abroad.
Right. Madeline, I have been doing this job for a long time. Usually I find myself not on purpose defending airlines. I think the general public doesn't understand how hard it is, how complex it is to run a global airline. This is the first time in a long time where I can't come up with a defense for why airlines have been caught so flat-footed. People should expect more from airlines, and it's possible that this has been such a debacle right now that we may need to see the government step in and say, look, airlines, you took tens of billions of dollars of what is essentially taxpayer money, and you have to get your act together.
What would that mean, though? Would they force them to hire more people or fly more planes? Like, how would a government intervention actually play out?
You know, it's hard to know how it would play out here, but this does happen from time to time. So you may remember about, 10 years ago, you and I might be on the radio talking about long tarmac delays. Airlines had kind of lost track of airplanes on the tarmac. So people would sit there for 3 to 6 hours without food or drink. And the government eventually came in and said, you can't do this anymore. And now we have tarmac delay fines for airlines. And they do absolutely everything they can to make sure that people aren't left out there for 3 hours without food or water. I don't know what it would look like here, but I wouldn't be shocked to see the Department of Transportation say, you guys have to get your act in order.
Right. As the holiday season is fast approaching, what is it going to be like to fly on an airplane in the next couple of months?
You know, if the weather is good nationwide, it probably will be perfectly normal to fly on an airplane. If there's thunderstorms on the East Coast or snowstorms in Chicago, or maybe even some rain here in LA, we know what that does to everything here. Things could get out of order really fast. So airlines are trying to be very efficient. They're trying to move people around the country. They don't have a lot of slack in the system. They don't have a lot of extra pilots or flight attendants or extra planes. And so as we talked about before, just one bit of bad weather somewhere in the country seems to cripple the system. So I think that if you're traveling for the Thanksgiving holiday, you should not only hope that there's good weather in LA, which tends to happen, but you should hope there's good weather absolutely everywhere. So wherever your airplane or the crew is coming from, that plane can get to LA on time and get you where you need to go.
Which doesn't seem likely because winter equals bad weather in most of the country.
Madeline, you make a very, very good point.
All right. So one airline has been relatively unscathed by all this drama, and that's United. And they've done a couple of things differently. Talk to us about that.
Yes, we should knock on wood because this could change at any time. But yes, United is very proud of what they have done. United saw the same thing that every other U.S. airline saw. They saw a lot of pent-up demand, people who desperately wanted to get back on airplanes at the end of 2021. But United said, look, we only have so many pilots. We only have so many flight attendants. Some of our planes are still in the desert. We're not flying them. We are not going to fly as many flights as we could, as we want to, because we're going to try to run a relatively on-time operation. And so far, that's worked out very well for United operationally. They may make a little less revenue than the other airlines, but they're not desperately trying to go after every single passenger. Sometimes they just say, you know what? We know that there's demand for another flight from Chicago to LA, but we just can't do it. So they don't do it.
They also implemented a vaccine mandate for their employees that does not include testing out. As other airlines are doing, right?
They did. More than 99% of their employees are vaccinated. There's some legal stuff going on for the last, 1% or less than 1%. But they are vaccinated. And it's pretty interesting to see because we're seeing a lot of airlines not wanting to tell their employees that they must get vaccinated.
Right. And so they're offering a testing alternative, which could be a problem, right? When you have a lot of people, let's say, calling in and saying they tested positive and they can't come into work last minute?
It absolutely is. You sound like United CEO Scott Kirby on the airline's earnings call last month. He was definitely poking at his competitors. He said, you think it's bad now when they have a thunderstorm in Dallas, Fort Worth? Wait till you see what happens when a bunch of employees call in sick at the very last minute and they can't fly your flight or be your flight attendant. It's going to be a disaster. He's obviously biased, right? He wants people to fly United, but he certainly makes a legitimate point.
Plus, fuel prices are going up. And does that mean ticket prices are going up too?
Generally, that's the case. Yeah. But you know what's making fuel or making ticket prices go up just as much? It's demand. Everybody wants to travel right now. We have been cooped up in our homes for a long time. Mm-hmm. Right now, we see a lot of flights actually sell out. That's how popular air travel is right now.
Wow. Would you get on a plane?
Absolutely. I've been on the show a few times and I said I wouldn't. But over the last 3 months, I've been flying again. I find it magical. I love it. And it's good to be back out there.
Brian Summers, editor at large for the travel industry publication Skift. Brian, always great to speak with you. Happy travels.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
How a young comedian taught senior citizens, like a woman named Helen Yaloff, how to do stand-up.
No matter what their experiences are, they all are interesting and funny. I was astonished with the class.
Newly minted performer Helen Yaloff and Joe Firestone join us next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yeah.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There wasn't offered before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Yes, we do. And when COVID hit, speaking of disasters, many of us went home and took on a pandemic hobby. We baked, we gardened, we rewatched every single episode of The Sopranos. But comedian Joe Firestone decided to teach an online comedy class for seniors between the ages of 66 and 88.
No, I'm Bibby Elvers. And am I comfortable saying my age? Of course, I'm proud of it. I'm 88 and a half. And going strong.
A new documentary called Good Timing with Joe Firestone follows these seniors as they prepare to do a stand-up routine before a live audience. And for many, it was the first time.
The man goes to the doctor and the doctor says, you know, you have to stop masturbating. He goes, why? Because I'm trying to examine you.
Thank you all for being here. Has anyone been to a 2 p.m. comedy show before?
Well, that's Joe Firestone, stand-up comedian and former writer for The Tonight Show, and she joins us now. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
And one of the comedians who signed up for her class is here, too, Helen Yaloff. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
Joe, let's begin with you. Your project is called Good Timing, and this class, I guess, really was well-timed because you began teaching just before the pandemic hit, and people needed something to do. So take it from there. The pandemic hits, and then what happens?
And we, you know, moved it onto Zoom, like just about everything that could be moved onto Zoom. And we started meeting every Monday, and we've continued to meet every Monday since then. I just saw Helen, 3 days ago.
Oh, yeah. So you're still doing it with the same group?
So basically, I sent an email to everyone in the class saying, hey, who wants to do this? We're going to film it. And 16 said yes. And 8 said, no, thanks. I'll just keep doing it on Zoom. And yeah, that's kind of how this came to be.
Mm-hmm. Helen, why did you say yes?
Are you kidding? It was a great opportunity. And I know some of the people that didn't say yes because they had doctor's appointments or something else. So they weren't feeling well. And we didn't just take the course because it was something to do. We took the course because it was fun. Mm-hmm. And it cheered up our lives incredibly, gave us something to look forward to.
Had you always wanted to try comedy?
I've done almost all of the arts. And there's been comedy, and I've written plays, I sing, I've acted. And it's usually comedy in what I've done, but I've never done a stand-up comedy thing. Or focused on comedy per se. It was always a side thing.
Mm-hmm. So was this a bit of a risk for you? Was it a little scary to begin this?
No, not scary. It was delightful to learn something new. I love it. I, it was nothing scary about anything in that class.
No. Well, Joe, is she's so friendly and appealing, I can see. So, Joe, why did you want to do this? Why did you want to work with seniors?
I was excited to work with a group of people that liked comedy. I think when you do comedy a lot, when you're in this kind of trying to do it professionally, you get kind of tripped up in like, you know, what's the next thing? How do I use this personality defect to make myself, you know, money? And I think that you kind of lose track of why you enjoy it in the first place. And so it was really cool to work with people that really just enjoyed comedy. And I'm sure some of them are trying to make, you know, careers out of it. But I think it's less about that. At least the focus of this group, we just kind of meet and make jokes and make each other laugh. And it's a really nice way to start the week.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. And you can see in the show that you give them tips, like, or you give them prompts, and then they just go with it.
I'm just going to say words, and you just say whether it's funny or not funny in by itself, okay? Ready? Peanuts.
Funny.
Funny. Salt.
Okay, how about treadmills?
Not at all. Very serious.
Gerbils?
Gerbils.
Definitely funny.
Gerbils are funny?
With Richard Gere. I'm sorry, I can't help it.
Describe how the class goes.
It kind of, I guess it feels kind of like some kind of game show. Helen, does that feel right? Where it's like kind of like a panel show where I just give a prompt and then everybody tells their jokes.
I look at it that you give us something to do, an exercise, and then we have to figure out how to do it. And we are learning through the exercises, and you're always incredibly positive. I find that absolutely amazing how positive you are about everything. So we're encouraged to just keep on going and taking chances like crazy.
And Joe, do you find the jokes funny?
Yes. Yeah. And it's also like, you know, I try to set up these activities so that people, you know, there's the only thing to do is surprise everybody else. So everybody's kind of surprised and delighted by everybody else's, you know, answers and stuff. Food jokes or sex jokes?
Food.
Okay.
Sex.
Okay.
Food.
Okay.
Food.
Barbara, you got one?
I got a quick one, and then I need help with the second.
Okay.
Two peanuts were in a bar. One was assaulted.
One was a what?
Assaulted.
Two penises?
Peanuts.
One prompt, Helen, you were very funny with this, was the worst place to propose marriage and the best place to wet your pants. Do you remember that exercise? I think we did it a couple of weeks ago.
I don't remember that one. Do you?
Yeah.
Well, let's do it as kind of an improv. Where is the worst place to propose marriage, Helen?
In a sewer? where you've just fallen down in it?
What about the worst, the best place to wet your pants?
In a taxi cab? So you can leave it fast?
I would say in the sewer because, well, you're already there.
Oh, but that's good for the sewer, but not for me, you know. I want to get someplace. I want to get out of that sewer. And also, there could be alligators there, you know?
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah, you never know about alligators.
Helen, you were interested in singing your stand-up, right?
I used to sing comedy songs, but nobody in comedy groups wanted someone to sing comedy songs. They wanted them to sing straight songs as a contrast. Uh-huh. But I do a number of funny songs, yeah.
And so what did you perform in the stand-up?
Well, I just briefly, Joe asked, I didn't do it in the stand-up. We did it in an interview beforehand. Mm-hmm. And Joe asked me to sing a song, and I decided to sing one of my songs because it was no royalties involved with that. Mm-hmm. It turned out that was not totally true. And so I just sung an old song that I did. I mean, I have lots of songs, which was not a particularly funny song, but it got into the show.
Toy balloon,
you as suck. You,
so do you, my darling.
And so what was it like being on stage, doing the stand-up?
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love being on stage.
You do?
I just love it. Yes.
What do you love about it?
I am the center of attention. I send love to the audience. The audience sends love to me. I rarely fail. Occasionally you fail. But most of the time I succeed, so I'm very happy with that.
Joe, what about the other students? Were some of them a little apprehensive to get on stage?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of them were very nervous. And one participant really didn't want to go on stage. And so I told her I'd buy her a drink if she went on stage. And then she really held me to that. I did have to buy her two drinks afterwards. But yeah, I think that, you know, some people were more, you know, experienced in theater and comedy like Helen, and some people really were doing it for the first time, and I thought it would be kind of low key because it was at 2 p.m. and you know, just friends and family in the audience. But then, you know, someone really like reminded me that there was five cameras and it was going to be on television, so
and you're on a stage in front of a real audience.
Yeah. And so there was a level. Yeah,
I want to say that the class is astonishing. We've lucked out with this particular group of people. No matter what their experiences are, they all are interesting and funny mm-hmm. people on a very high level. I was astonished with the class. Yes.
So none of you knew each other before, people in the class?
I occasionally knew one or two people in passing, and I brought in one or two people, but I didn't know them well enough. And I've gotten to know a lot more people in the class that, inside and out of the class, and I'm very, very happy with that. It was a deeper way of getting to know people.
Yeah. Sounds like a great community that was formed through this.
They're a very great, unusual class. Yeah.
Yeah. Joe, I'm wondering, you are a professional comedian. Did you learn anything about comedy from your students?
Yes, so much. I think that I was just thinking about how I didn't really write much, like I didn't really write much material or do much stand up during the quarantine. And I was just like kind of amazed every Monday when people would do these assignments that I kind of arbitrarily gave to the group, and they would do them and like really go above and beyond. And I think just like how prolific everybody is in the group and how much everybody really wants to make jokes and make each other laugh, it makes me excited to do comedy in that way.
Is it different with older people? Like they've been through a lot and maybe they're not as self-conscious?
That might be it. I also think that it's just kind of fun. Like there's so many stories and so much experience that I don't have that there was one prompt where I was asking everybody to talk about school and like, cause back to school or whatever. And Helen and I think several other people all had to do sewing assignments, and that had gone away by the time I came to school. But Helen, do you remember that everybody had a sewing assignment story?
Yes, that was amazing. they wouldn't let me get out of public school unless I sewed my graduation dress. So there I was, the day of graduation, hand sewing my dress.
Wow.
And the person that won the sewing award, her mother sewed the dress. That was really, and we couldn't say anything. But she ended up being a gangster's moll and was almost killed. I saw a paper on the newspapers.
Wow.
So that made me happy.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, see, lots of stories, lots of material to mine.
Oh, yes.
We're not having to please the audience that's the usual audience, which is in comedy clubs, young people bring their dates and they don't really care so much about it. We're pleasing people who really care about what we're saying.
Yeah. Well, that's so great. And so this is going to continue for the foreseeable future?
Forever and ever, I hope.
Yeah, forever and ever. It's, yeah, we have like a group of about 24 people and we meet every Monday, and I think there's going to be like, cause we had to close off the class cause after 24 people, it kind of gets, the Zoom gets a little unwieldy. So there's like a limited time class I'm starting for November, but yeah, this class keeps going and we don't have any sign of stopping, which is nice. Yeah.
Somebody asked to pay me money to get them in the class.
Oh, wow.
It is a free class. So Helen would be extorting this person.
I could have gotten money on the side. Yeah. I wouldn't have taken this class if it wasn't for COVID, because the class was at 10 in the morning and you had to get there. And I thought, oh, I have to get up, I have to get breakfast, I have to put stockings, I have to do this, I have to do that. I'm not going to go and be funny at 10 in the morning. No, 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 the hell with it. But then when COVID started, I said, oh, on Zoom. So one day Joe said, Helen, are you eating your breakfast? I said, yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was nice and fun to come and have your breakfast or your coffee with Joe and the rest of the class.
Well, thank you both so much for coming on the show today, and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This was fun. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That's Joe Firestone, stand-up comedian and former writer for The Tonight Show, Helen Yalov, one of her students. And you can see them both in the new show on Peacock called Good Timing with Joe Firestone. Coming up, billionaire Charles Munger's architectural design for UC Santa Barbara dorms is causing a lot of outrage because the dorm rooms, most of them, have no windows. We'll have the details next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Some are calling it Dormzilla. UC Santa Barbara is planning an 11-story dorm to house more than 4,000 students. The project is partially funded by billionaire investor Charlie Munger of Berkshire Hathaway. $200 million, and in exchange, the school has to use his architectural design for the building. But lots of people hate the design, including an architect from UCSB's Design Review Committee who resigned in protest, saying, quote, the basic concept of Munger Hall as a place for students to live is unsupportable from my perspective as an architect, a parent, and a human being. Yikes. And that's because most of the rooms, well, they have no windows. Joining us to talk about this is Henry Grabar. He's staff writer for Slate. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, looking at the pictures of this design, you do see windows on the outside of the dorm. But I guess most of the rooms are on the inside and they're not facing outside at all?
Right. What you have to understand is that this building, the square footage inside this building is about 1.5 times the size of the Chrysler building. So there may be windows on the outside, but there's a lot of interior space that is really, really far from those windows. And so the system is that while every student will be in a suite that has access to fresh air and natural light, most of the bedrooms do not, because most of the bedrooms are in the interior of the building. And unlike, you know, what you might see in a pre-war skyscraper in downtown L.A., these buildings, it's not designed in the shape of a U or an E or an H to give, you know, with light shafts and all that. There is no light or air, natural air in the middle of the building there.
Right. Okay. So he, Charlie Munger, who, by the way, is 97 years old and does appear to be pretty, very cogent, gave an interview to CNN, and this is how he described how the rooms will be lit.
And that artificial window delivers the exact spectrum of daylight. You cannot tell that it's artificial by looking at it. And in addition, the student in this room can twist a knob and he can brighten up the sun or dim it down.
Okay, so he's making it sound even better than having windows. I think he even said that this is better than having windows. So,
well, I think we should ask Mr. Munger if he has any windows in his house, or he's decided to go with these knob-tuned windows as well.
Right. Well, was this the only way to design such a big dorm to have it like this?
I mean, you know, I think part of what we're looking at here is just how desperate UCSB is to create housing for students, right? Like, things are really bad at UCSB. A lot of the UC schools, a lot of colleges in California, where you have kids living in, you know, at UCSB, kids are living in hotel rooms, for example. So they're really desperate to put this plot of land to the maximum possible utility, which means essentially putting a number of undergrads, basically the size of all of Yale College, into one building. And when I talked to residential life faculty or administrators at other colleges, that was one of the big concerns they had. You know, they said, we don't like the fact that there are no windows in the bedrooms, but we also don't like the fact that there's 4,000 students in one building. It's too big to facilitate a sense of community.
Right. And so it hasn't been built yet. This is just the design. But is there any way of changing it?
Well, in spite of all the outrage that happened on Friday and Monday and over the weekend when this thing went viral, the university says they're sticking to the plan. And obviously, you know, I think part of what's happening here is you see the extent to which even nominally public institutions are beholden to the wishes of donors, right? Like, he has $200 million. He's basically paying them $200 million to be able to design this building, which is a fairly unusual sort of restricted donation. And that, you know, that's a small fraction of the cost of the dorm, but that's also a lot of money. So that's why they're doing it. And they don't seem to have changed their mind since Friday, at least.
Well, this is not the first time that he's done this. And here he is in that CNN interview talking about where he did it before.
I have built a dorm just like this at the University of Michigan with no windows in the bedrooms at all. Everybody loves it. They fight to get in.
I don't know if that's true, but
I looked up some of the ratings online, and it's actually the highest rated dorm on the Ann Arbor campus. So some people do seem to think it's a good trade-off. And in fact, in Slate Slack this week, we were arguing about it, and several people said they would rather have had a windowless bedroom in a suite than share a room with a total stranger, which is obviously the status quo for a lot of people in their first year of college. So that's the argument that Munger has made as well. Now, I would say perhaps we could offer students both single bedrooms and bedrooms with windows. Like, could we maybe get both?
Now, that's that's a little rich, a little too much for that. Well, and may I point out that Santa Barbara is known for its great weather and sun, whereas Ann Arbor, Michigan, well, there are long winters where people don't see the sun anyway for long, so maybe they don't miss it as much.
Yes, and you could see that either way. Like, maybe Santa Barbara is a place where you hope that the students are going to be spending most of their time outside. So mm-hmm. maybe they won't be so bothered by the fact that this dorm is windowless. I guess, you know, Santa Barbara seems to think, you know, all these colleges are always, they're competing for students, right? And they're competing for students' parents, especially out of state or international students who will pay full freight, right? So to some extent, the people in charge at UCSB must think that this thing, when it's finished and the uproar dies down, is going to be an appealing thing to stick on the cover of a brochure and to take parents on tours of.
Right. Because as you say, despite all of this criticism and backlash, they're sticking by it. They're not changing anything.
Right. And I think that speaks to the extent to which the status quo is really, really bad. Right. So, like, it's easy for this insane dorm to go viral. And, you know, the comparisons I heard were to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, a self-storage facility, a prison ship. And, you know, it's we're having a lot of fun with these blueprints, right? But, like, the reality in Santa Barbara is kids living in hotel rooms. At other schools, you have kids living in garages, tripled up. There are colleges in California where homeless students sleep in their cars in the parking lots. So that's not funny. That's not going to go viral on Twitter. But that is, to some extent, the status quo that a place like UCSB is looking at when they feel the need to try and cram 4,500 students onto this one piece of property. So it just goes to show the extent to which the California housing crisis has come for college students. And you know, I think that is one of the realities that leads to this dorm getting greenlit.
Right. And the fact that universities, as you mentioned, they need money and they need help with all that.
Right. I mean, to some extent, like, I don't want to play devil's advocate too much defending Charlie Munger here, but, like, there's a lot of rich donors who earmark their money for far less useful causes than this, right? Like, there's donors who insist on, you know, funding a renovation of the, you know, boathouse or whatever it is. And at least Munger here, his priorities are to some extent in line with the universities, albeit with this very unusual caveat, which is that he insists on them using his design.
Well, he's a 97-year-old billionaire, after all. He can do pretty much whatever he wants. Henry Grabar is staff writer for Slate. And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.